Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Wendy Ward. I represent the appellant, Michael Kingsley. It is difficult to understand here how a properly instructed jury could have reached any conclusion other than that Mr. Kingsley's rights were violated when he was tased while face down, handcuffed, and surrounded by officers. In fact, the defendants in their brief did a nice job of laying out step by step just what happened from the perspective of the defendants. And their extensive recitation of the facts here leaves little room to doubt that Mr. Kingsley was tased, not because he presented a threat to anyone's safety or the security of the institution, but because he had irritated and annoyed the defendants. That is punishment, and that is not permitted under the Constitution. Now, the standard for an excessive force claim brought under the 14th Amendment is accurately set forth in Pattern Instruction 7.08. The question for the jury is whether the force used was unreasonable under the circumstances. The jury instructions here, however, required Mr. Kingsley to prove two additional elements. One, that the defendants recklessly disregarded Mr. Kingsley's safety, and two, that Mr. Kingsley was harmed. And I will address those additional elements in order. With respect to that reckless disregard element, we can really categorize the types of constitutional cases where pretrial detainees allege violations by prison officials. In the first category of case, the harm is caused by inaction or accident. In the second type of case, the harm is caused by deliberate conduct. The first type of case includes, for example, the failure to protect or the conditions of confinement type cases. That type of case does require plaintiffs to demonstrate some form of deliberate indifference or reckless disregard because negligent conduct is insufficient to establish a constitutional violation, and that's the Daniels v. Williams case. The second type of case includes excessive force claims where the deliberateness of the action is usually not in question, and elaboration of the intent element is therefore not necessary. So in this case, no one is arguing that Officer Degner had unholstered his taser, had it powered up, was brandishing, to use a word from an earlier case, and slipped and fell and made contact with Mr. Kingsley's shoulder. If that were Mr. Kingsley's claim, the reckless disregard jury instruction might have made sense. That is not this case. Here, the defendants admit that Sergeant Hendrickson ordered Officer Degner to apply the taser, and Officer Degner then did deliberately apply the taser to Mr. Kingsley. In this context, the only relevant question is whether that use of the taser was unreasonable under the circumstances. That is the holding of Wilson v. Williams, and that is how the jury should have been instructed here. Instead, the jury was required to determine whether the defendants recklessly disregarded Mr. Kingsley's safety in the act of tasing him. That instruction did not accurately reflect the law, and it made no sense. So if Your Honors have no questions about that element of the instructions, I'll move on into the harm element of the instructions. Your Honors, the use of a taser in stun mode is known as a pain compliance technique. That qualifies as harm as a matter of law under the constitutional jurisprudence of this court. The jury instructions here, however, required not only a showing of harm as an element of liability, but also confusingly suggested a sufficient level of harm must be shown. The instructions were erroneous, and Mr. Kingsley is entitled to a new trial as a result.
Would you have been satisfied on that particular point if the district court had said pain can constitute harm sufficient to prove the plaintiff's case?
Yes, Your Honor, and we actually requested that as a clarifying instruction below. The court refused to adopt that clarifying instruction and on the fly sort of fashioned her own clarifying instruction, and we tried to sort of mitigate the damage of what she was doing with her clarifying instruction at the time.
Did the defense argue to the jury that there simply was no significant pain or injury here?
They did a couple times, opening and closing both, Your Honor. They said that Mr. Kingsley's injuries weren't severe.
But then, I mean, if that's the argument, the district judges edited the instructions, took that out of the case, right? A person can be harmed even if he did not suffer a severe injury.
Correct. The problem with that clarifying instruction is it suggested, in combination with harm as an element for liability, that Mr. Kingsley was required to meet some threshold level of harm And in conjunction with arguments by counsel that his injury wasn't severe, it allowed, as an element of liability, the jury to determine whether he was sufficiently injured to constitute the violation of his rights.
Is it your position that that whole question ought to be put off to damages? Or what? The committee that put together the pattern instruction obviously struggled with it and left us to decide what to do.
Correct. So they left it sort of to the discretion of the trial court judges whether to use the harm instruction. I think to answer your question about damages, it is appropriately argued at damages. But as an element of liability, it really makes no sense where Mr. Kingsley was tased, and under this court's jurisprudence, a tasing is a painful and frightening blow that constitutes harm as a matter of law. So to conclude, I'm actually early, I see, but if this verdict is allowed to stand, prison officials will receive a message that it is okay to tase pretrial detainees merely for being annoying. That cannot be the correct result under our constitutional case law. The verdict below should be vacated, and this case should be remanded for a new trial.
Thank you, Ms. Warden.
Thank you.
Mr. Posnanski, for the defense.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Tim Posnanski. I have the privilege of representing Lieutenant Stan Hendrickson and Officer Fritz Degner. May it please the Court. The standard here is whether, as a whole, the correct message was conveyed to the jury reasonably well. The District Court conveyed the correct message to the jury and closely tracked this Court's approach in Wilson. Accordingly, we respectfully request this Court affirm the District Court. There is no dispute here that Mr. Kingsley was a pretrial detainee. There's no dispute that the 14th Amendment, and not the 4th Amendment, applies to pretrial detainees. The 14th Amendment prohibits punishment. The proper inquiry under the 14th Amendment is whether the act complained of constitutes punishment. Punishment implies intent. Punishment is a deliberate act intended to chastise or deter. The search for punishment, therefore, cannot be wholly objective. There are differences between the 4th.
What do you make of the language in Wilson, that language lifted from Graham was intended to apply to excessive force claims raised explicitly under the 4th Amendment? We do not consider it nor the test which it espouses inappropriate in the context here, which involved similar use of force against a pretrial detainee. An objective test.
And I see that, Your Honor, and I think that's correct. I mean, I think there's two things. Number one, saying it's not necessarily inappropriate here is not the same thing as saying it's appropriate. I think we have to keep in mind what the court's role is in reviewing jury instructions. The court avoids fastidiousness. It reviews the instructions to see if the proper message was conveyed.
The instruction here referred to whether the defense recklessly disregarded plaintiff's safety by failing to take reasonable measures to minimize the risk of harm to plaintiff. If I'm on the jury, what does that mean to me? What measures, reasonable measures, to minimize the risk of harm to plaintiff were available?
Well, and that goes to the evidence, Your Honor. What was available to minimize the harm to the plaintiff were the efforts that the officers had engaged in through the course of this incident. They had tried to control him from their initial orders and their initial instructions from the time they went to his cell to extract him through the time they moved him into the segregation cell. At that time...
Well, the plaintiff's theory is whatever happened before, at the time the taser's applied, he's subdued and compliant. I know that's disputed, but we've got to assume that that's a possible finding here. If he's subdued and compliant, is it up to the plaintiff to identify reasonable measures to minimize the risk of harm that the defendants failed to take?
It's incumbent on the plaintiff to demonstrate some subjective intent to punish him. The officers were acting, the measures they took had no legitimate penological purpose.
That's not what the instruction says.
The instruction says that they had to recklessly disregard his safety. The instruction...
It's not an intent to punish, right? That's a little different, isn't it?
It is a little bit different. And I think if we were going to have a discussion on what the other part of Wilson says, where it does talk about the subjective intent the officers must prove that wasn't given here. But in Wilson, we're talking about this, the sentence coming from verbatim, the objective analysis coming from Graham, and it's not necessarily inappropriate in this context. Well, that only makes sense in light of the prefatory instructions that the court had given regarding what the specific right was that was involved, the right to be free from punishment, punishment being a deliberate act intended to chastise or deter, which is the appropriate definition of punishment. And only in light of those is it appropriate to allow the jury to infer intent. If the jury doesn't know that intent is a relevant consideration, it can't make that inference. It can't draw that conclusion from the objective factors.
Why shouldn't we just basically stick with the work of the committee that put together the pattern instruction 7.08 that makes this a pretty straightforward inquiry?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe we should stick with that. The district court didn't think we should stick with the pattern instruction. Graham tells us that the Supreme Court has specifically rejected the notion that all excessive force claims are governed by a single standard, and the analysis must begin with identifying the specific right at issue. Here, it was the right to be free from punishment, and the pattern instruction is a Fourth Amendment instruction. The Fourth Amendment has temporal limits and doesn't apply. There's no dispute here. And the 14th Amendment prescribes punishment. It requires that intent. In Wilson, Salazar, Anderson, Daniels, they require intentional or at least reckless conduct to prove a violation of due process rights. And the 14th Amendment does not have any such requirement on account of this mental element, as Titran says.
Well, it sounds like you're telling us we ought to, that the district judge did not give instructions favorable enough to the defense. Right. You think that there should have been language saying there must be conscious intent to punish, that recklessness might be enough to satisfy that, but the focus ought to be on intent to punish. Is that right?
I think there must be an intent to punish, whether that's shown through actual intent or whether it's recklessness. We know that recklessness can be a proxy for intent where there's no evidence of actual intent to punish. And here there was no evidence there was actual intent to punish.
What if the intent is simply to subdue and Mr. Kingsley is beaten until he's unconscious, no longer resisting?
Well,
is that a violation of his constitutional rights?
If I understand the question, if in the context of
the
trying
officer
to...
officer testifies, I had no intent to punish him. I simply wanted to make sure he was not resisting any further. Is that a good defense when the beating goes on long after he has stopped resisting?
Well, I think there's two responses to that question. Number one, it goes to the officer's credibility, which the jury will determine if that response is credible.
They believe he's sincere about that. He's scared. Maybe he's faced with a very difficult, resistant prisoner. I recognize that.
Well, and in that context, Your Honor, even if the beating goes on long after he's subdued, he's stopped resisting, then it goes to the Hudson factors, which were given to the jury in this case. The jury still needs to consider whether or not the force used was reasonable under the circumstances confronting the officer.
Sure, but that's satisfied. The question is whether it's a defense for the officer to say, I was not trying to punish him.
I think that's for the jury.
You think that's a good defense?
I don't think it's a good defense. If the facts before the jury are that the beating took place and continued long after the inmate was subdued, then I think they can infer that, regardless of his testimony, that I sincerely didn't have an intent to punish him, they can infer that punitive intent, the prohibited punitive intent that Wilson discusses, from the objective factors of the Hudson factors. The district court gave instructions that were similar to the instructions given in Wilson. As in Wilson, the district court instructed the jury regarding the subjective intent that the plaintiff must prove, As in Wilson, the district court instructed the jury to determine whether the defendant's use of force was unreasonable under the circumstances. And as in Wilson, the court instructed the jury that in reaching its determination as to whether the defendants used unreasonable force and whether they acted with the necessary intent, they could consider the Hudson factors in reaching their ultimate conclusion. These instructions conveyed the law to the jury reasonably well and are consistent with the instructions approved in Wilson. The appellant now concedes in his reply brief that he must prove the defendants acted with an intent to punish. The Wilson instructions included language to that effect. Instructions here included language to that effect. Your Honor, I see that appears on page 3 of the appellant's reply brief, near the bottom of the page. Yet the appellant requested instructions that were entirely silent regarding the intent to punish. This court has explicitly instructed that claims under the Due Process Clause require proof of an intent, and the Fourth Amendment instruction does not incorporate the defendant's intent, and in fact specifically instructs the jury not to consider the defendant's intent. So the appellant's proposed instruction would not put the jury on notice that any such showing was required. It's not possible to divorce the Hudson factors in the Wilson court analysis from the prefatory instructions. Again, if the objective factors are only sufficient to allow the jury to infer an intent to punish, if you've told the jury they need to make such a determination or reach that conclusion. With respect to the harm instruction, the requirement that a pretrial detainee prove harm, some harm comes directly from Wilson, and the pattern jury instruction suggests that a district court should give this instruction at its discretion. In its discretion, the district court did just that. The district court added a clarifying instruction at Mr. Kingsley's request, and that changed the language actually from what the court was prepared to give. The court was prepared to add, a person can be harmed even if he does not suffer a lasting injury, to which appellant's counsel suggested adding severe injury. He cannot now complain of the exact language he offered the district court. The instructions.
Thank you, counsel. Do you have a last word you need to give us?
We respectfully request that you affirm the district court.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Rebuttal, Ms. Warden.
I'm going to take the last point first with respect to the waiver argument that the defendants made. The record reflects that Mr. Kingsley's counsel objected to the harm element being included as a liability instruction, never withdrew that objection at any point, and then requested a clarifying instruction that they would have endorsed or that we would have endorsed, and then only went to the point of trying to mitigate the problem with the instructions after the court had already twice rejected Mr. Kingsley's proposed language. The facts here are nothing like the cases cited in their brief where the complainant, the appellant, has actually suggested the language that was later adopted by the court. It's not even close to what happened here. With respect to intent to punish, I just wanted to point out that while they're careful to define it as a deliberate act to chastise or deter, which is what punishment is, they didn't suggest any language such as that be included in the jury instructions. And we've always acknowledged that an intent to punish is necessary, but the direct holding of Wilson, and which is what we endorsed as our jury instructions, were that the objective factors can be used to determine whether the requisite level of intent is present, because if there is any direct evidence of intent, I think as you pointed out, there's often going to be only self-serving testimony that I didn't mean to do it. So the objective factors of Wilson are the appropriate proxy for intent and not the reckless disregard language, which in this case was confusing in context. Nothing further. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Our thanks to both counsel.